So we've talked about cooperation and we've talked about defection. When we first started talking about cooperation, we were talking about cooperation actually as it can occur within a single genome, that is, within a single individual. Then we talked about cooperation more formally, and what we focused on was cooperation as it can occur within a given species, that'd be intraspecific cooperation. Those ideas can be expanded to include between species, but we really considered it mostly from the perspective of an individual species and the members of that species interacting with one another. They may have varied in terms of the degree to which they would cooperate or defect, but by and large, we were considering just cooperation within a species. When we talked about mutation occurring, mutation to a less cooperative genotype, we're talking still about cooperation going on within a given species. Even when we talked about defection from without, these individuals, these cheaters, this, I guess cheating from without, moving into a group of cooperative cells, we really were thinking at that point either in terms of within species, so a defector that is just a different genotype but still the same species, or alternatively, perhaps a parasite, which would be a different species. In the following chapter, we talk about symbioses and we concentrated on mutualisms. And mutualisms basically, and symbioses are basically interactions between different species. And if the mutualism is a cooperative phenomenon, which indeed it is, then we're talking about cooperation between different species. In this chapter, which is on virulence, we're going to be talking also about cooperation as it can occur within species. And defection as it can occur between species. So in this case, the defection is obvious. Virulence is the capacity to cause disease, so defection is the potential to cause disease in a host organism as affected by a parasite. The cooperation, however, is within the parasite population, and particularly we're going to return to these ideas of showing restraint, such as upon one's population growth. A lack of restraint can lead to an increase in the amount of virulence seen, and that might actually have negative consequences in terms of the fitness of a pathogen. And if that's the case, then those pathogens that can figure out how to cooperate within the pathogen population, especially within populations of pathogens that are infecting a single host, then that population of pathogens may display a greater fitness. Than a population of pathogens that shows less restraint on its capacity to cause disease in the host. And what level of virulence ultimately will evolve will be dependent upon the degree to which these pathogens can display restraint, can be cooperative within pathogen populations, in combination with what degree of virulence actually gives rise to an optimal fitness for the pathogen. And whether or not the pathogen can realize that level of virulence will be dependent upon the degree to which the pathogen population essentially can display kin selection, to the extent they can be clonal and they can take advantage of inclusive fitness in order to show restraint and thereby restrain themselves at whatever the optimal virulence for the population may be. So the general theme of this chapter is virulence. Virulence is either an interspecific defection or it can involve an intraspecific cooperation, and particularly we're interested in the evolution of virulence. So the evolution of parasite virulence. So now we consider the potential impact of parasite life histories on their virulence evolution. So parasites have certain characteristics that can affect the utility of lesser or greater virulence in terms of transmission potential. And this is, for example, parasites that require direct contact for transmission tend to display lower virulence because their host vector typically is more effective if ambulatory. Sexually transmitted diseases additionally require sexual functionality and desire, so hence tend to display low virulence, at least in the short term. Sexual transmission is a special kind of direct contact transmission. Parasites that display high extraorganismal durability, by contrast, can get away with higher virulence by displaying a sit-and-wait transmission strategy. So what we'll be doing is walking through various scenarios for parasite transmission and considering how all of these impact the potential for higher virulence to evolve in these parasites. Just to remind you what transmission of parasites or pathogens is all about. So there's contact transmission. Direct contact transmission is obviously where two individuals touch each other. Indirect contact is mediated through something called fomites. Here, an individual is stepping on a nail and picking up presumably Clostridium tetani. There's also droplet transmission where you're, for example, sneezing or coughing on an individual. There's various kinds of vehicle transmission. There's transmission via water. There's transmission via air. There's transmission via food. A vehicle is something that we normally take into our body that could be, in fact, carrying a pathogen. And then there's vector transmission. This is an arthropod vector, a fly that's carrying pathogens, presumably from garbage or from feces, it could be, to food that we're then going to consume. And here we have another example of a vector transmission where the vector is playing a more active role in the biology of the parasite that's being transmitted. So the impact of parasite life histories. So parasites that are transferred by vectors, such as by arthropod vectors, can benefit from host sickness, such that the vector is less likely to be shooed away, for example. Therefore, these parasites that are transferred by arthropod vectors often can get away with displaying a significant amount of virulence. And this also can be the case for attendant-borne diseases, where the attendant, such as in a clinic, can serve as the vector of disease transmission. Again, an individual can be pretty sick, but a nurse, for example, can still very readily come in contact with these individuals and potentially transmit infectious diseases from, as well as to, these individuals. Parasites that employ host disease as part of their transmission strategy can also benefit from significant virulence. So an example of this would be diarrhea as a means of transmission out of an individual. Also, there are a couple of cases where organisms actually melt in response to infections, such as the case with Ebola, where the individuals bleed out, and baculovirus, which is an infection of insect, such as caterpillars. And then there's also a possibility that childbirth fever from the 19th century displayed this kind of increase in virulence as a consequence of using host disease as a mechanism of transmission, or at least a component of their mechanism of transmission. The hypothesis here is that what you had are individuals that went to hospitals to give birth, and if those individuals happen to contract childbirth fever and die, childbirth fever is caused by Streptococcus pyogenes, and die in the hospital, then they would be autopsied by the a physician, who then would move on to the next individual who they would aid in childbirth, potentially transmitting the childbirth fever, the streptococcus, to this next individual. It was those individuals who died in the hospital that would be autopsied and therefore would have the highest potential for transmitting the pathogen to the next susceptible host. And therefore, those individuals that were experiencing a higher level of disease, those pathogens that affected a higher level of virulence, that kept the individuals in the hospital and caused them to die there, would be selected for within these systems. And so higher levels of disease, in this case, seems to have given rise to a greater level of contact with the vector for disease transmission, the attending physician, and as a consequence, maybe a higher level of virulence actually evolved in that system. I should point out before going further that this occurred in the days before physicians actually washed their hands between patients. This is very much prior to the full implementation of what we understand now about the utility of hand washing as supplied to us by Semmelweis, who actually ironically also died of a Streptococcus pyogenes infection. So parasites can actually manipulate their host's behavior in ways that actually also result in an increase in the parasite's virulence. So in the case of the malarial parasite, the life cycle is shown here. The malarial parasite has the effect of causing fevers in the human host. And these fevers, to a degree, immobilize the host and make them less able to swat off attacking mosquitoes. And as a consequence, another mosquito can come along and take a blood meal and thus continue the life cycle in the mosquito. And there's also manipulation, for example, in the rabies virus, where it makes the host more aggressive, and that can lead to greater levels of transmission of that virus. There's also at least speculation that I was once privy to, where an individual was suggesting that perhaps with Lyme disease, the reason why the Lyme disease spirochete causes arthritis-like symptoms is because it kind of cripples the normal mouse hosts of these ticks, and as a consequence of the tick vectors, and as a consequence, the tick, the house mouse may be more susceptible to picking up ticks, and as a consequence, the spirochete is able to be transmitted to new vectors. So there's lots of ways that that virulence can be affected by the life history of the parasites, leading to different levels of virulence in these parasites once evolution of virulence is factored in. So if we think of acute infections, so these are infections that last relatively short periods of time, for acute infectious diseases, theory about the evolution of virulence focuses on the negative effects of virulence on the transmission of pathogens between hosts. Much of the variation in these negative effects of virulence depends on whether pathogens can be transmitted from hosts that have become immobilized by the infections. Pathogens that can be transmitted readily from immobile hosts should be molded by natural selection to exploit the host severely and to be highly virulent. The reason is simple. Variants that exploit severely gain the competitive advantages of this exploitation. That is, they win the within-host competition for increasing expedience, while incurring little, if any, competitive cost from the illness that their exploitation generates, because they still can be transmitted from hosts that have severe immobilizing illness. So if you can knock out your host to the point where the host isn't even able to move around and yet still be transmitted from that host, there's little keeping you from severely victimizing the host, from displaying a large amount of virulence by causing a large amount of disease. To some degree, this is similar to that example of childbirth fever, where it was the individuals that were sufficiently immobilized that they actually stayed in the hospital and died there, that were more likely to be transmitted by the doctors who conducted the autopsies and then moved on to other potential hosts. And this is my example of what this all looks like. If when I was home, immobilized, sick in bed, if I could still transmit, then there'd be nothing keeping the parasite from making me really, really, really sick to the point where I was immobilized at home in bed. And in fact, as we'll see, I mean, this is something that it may very well be relevant in terms of transmission within hospitals. But if it's the parasite instead needs to actually have its host be moving around among other hosts in order for transmission to take place, to not be immobilized, then lower levels of virulence may be selected for in order to enhance the potential for transmission of the parasite. We can also consider vector-borne parasites again. So these are rules of thumb that I'll go through. Not all of the parasites display or conform to these rules of thumb, but we might predict that for a vector-borne parasite, that they'll be less concerned about host health. And in fact, decreases in host health can actually increase susceptibility to vectors, which is the case that we considered in terms of malaria. There is less concern about host mobility, and this is because the vector itself can be highly mobile, such as the case, for example, with mosquitoes, and thus carry the parasite to new hosts, new susceptible hosts, rather than the host itself carrying the parasite to new hosts. There can be a desirability for a long transmissibility window because while infecting, for example, a human host, the transmission of the parasite is not going to occur unless another vector comes along, such as another mosquito, and there might be a long delay before another vector comes along and, for example, takes a blood meal and thereby picks up the parasite. And so the longer you can increase the time during which transmissibility is possible, essentially the more vectors that the host is going to come in contact with, and therefore the greater the potential for transmission. There also can be no reason for durability outside of the host because these are parasites that are transmitted within another host. And so the parasite never really exits a host. It goes from being inside of one host to being inside of another host to being inside of another host. And as a consequence, there can be little selection for extra host durability. And there also can be a potential for high disease severity, in part because there is no reason to keep the host mobile if a vector is going to be responsible for the mobility of the parasite. On the other hand, if a long transmissibility window is desirable, that can interfere with the ability of the parasite to be able to put up with high levels of disease. Because that, in fact, could cause the window of transmissibility to close, for example, by killing the host. So not all of these apply to all possible vector-borne parasites, but a vector-borne parasite certainly can cause a great deal of disease if indeed it is the parasite that is being transmitted by a vector that really can pick up the parasite regardless of the level of disease that is displayed by the host. So virulence does not necessarily interfere with transmissibility in the case of vector-borne parasites, so long as it does not affect susceptibility to vectors. And in fact, high levels of disease can even potentially increase the potential for susceptibility to vectors. Although, as noted, there also is a desirability of a long transmissibility window, and high levels of disease potentially could interfere with that. Parasites transmitted by biting arthropods can be transmitted effectively from immobilized hosts and therefore should evolve to a higher level of virulence than directly transmitted parasites. Vector-borne parasites are more lethal on a per-infectious basis than directly transmitted pathogens. And this is from a review by Ewald from 2004. Here is shown just a number of vector-borne parasites. So malaria is transmitted by mosquitoes. Equine encephalitis is also transmitted by mosquitoes, as is yellow fever, which is a viral-borne disease the equine encephalitis is. We have plague, which is a bacterial-borne disease, Yersinia pestis, that's transmitted by fleas, which is another kind of arthropod. Typhus, epidemic typhus, is transmitted by a louse. There's speculation that, in fact, one reason why Hitler lost the battle for Russia during World War II was that his soldiers were not just ill-equipped, but also ill-supplied, and they were, as a consequence of simply not being well taken care of, louse-ridden, and this allowed epidemic typhus to spread among them and weaken the troops. There is Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which is a tick-borne pathogen caused by a rickettsia kind of bacteria. And then there's Lyme disease, which is also tick-borne, which is caused by the spirochete, another kind of bacterium, Borrelia burgdorferi. So we next can turn to consideration of waterborne parasites. This is a depiction of John Snow's source of the cholera epidemic in London that basically he figured out where the cholera was coming from, removed the handle from the associated water pump, and curtailed the epidemic. And so this is a depiction of sewage contaminated drinking water, and very typically when you have a waterborne parasite, we're talking about something that has a fecal-oral transmission strategy where the feces find their way into water, and then the water, contaminated water, is consumed, and thus leading to infection of the next host. So we can once again talk about rules of thumb. So there's less concern about host health by waterborne pathogens, and in fact they can even decrease host health to their advantage, causing diarrhea, which is a means by which they can be transmitted out of infected hosts. There is less concern about mobility, particularly if this diarrhea can basically get all over everything. That's a pretty effective route towards transmission. On the other hand, it is helpful if it's a waterborne pathogen for the diarrhea to find its way into a water supply, which may require some degree of host mobility. There's often a relatively short transmissibility window from the host. However, there is or can be a relatively long transmissibility window from the water. Once the parasite has made it into the water, it can remain infectious for fairly long periods of time. With Giardiasis, you can actually have fairly long transmissibility windows out of the host, and also long persistence of the Giardiasis within water, or the Giardia within water. High extra host durability is important, which of course increases the transmissibility window to new hosts, but not necessarily from the host. That is, persistence in the water is one of the things that can allow for these parasites to be effective in causing and transmitting diseases, because their job basically is to find their way into water and just stay there until a new host picks them up by drinking the water. There also can be potentially high disease severity, particularly if these diseases are limited by the host immune system in some capacity. These pathogens, because they don't really care about, or parasites, because they don't really care about host health, their job is to make as many of their babies as they can and transmit as many of those babies out of the host, such as via diarrhea. And so they can cause quite a bit of disease, again, which is seen with cholera. So virulence can be high in the short term, since so long as parasites can reach the water, then water serves to connect infected hosts with susceptible hosts. The lethality of diarrheal bacteria is correlated positively with the extent to which they are waterborne. Among Shigella, for example, severe strains have been disproportionately common where the potential for waterborne transmission is high. And again, that's from Ewald. And so this is the life cycle of Giardia. And what you have is the release of the cysts into water, and also they can contaminate food. And in fact, in daycare centers, there's a potential for direct fecal-oral transmission of Giardia among preschoolers, since they tend to be a little bit more free in their in where they touch themselves and how frequently they wash their hands. But at any rate, Giardia in their cysts can find their way into water and spend a great deal of time surviving there, where they can be picked up by other individuals, causing giardiasis in those new individuals. So there's also this potential for long-term shedding from individuals that are infected with Giardia. And finally, the cysts are able to persist in the water for long periods of time, basically extending their transmissibility window by acting effectively as what can be described as sit-and-wait pathogens or sit-and-wait parasites. We can also talk about attendant-borne diseases. So attendants would be individuals that work in clinics and tend to patients. So like vector-borne and water-borne pathogens, pathogens acquired while in the hospital can be transmitted from immobile hosts. In this case, the transporting is done on the hands of doctors, nurses, and other attendants and the objects that they touch. Such attendant-borne transmission is the major route for most serious hospital-acquired pathogens such as Staphylococci, Streptococci, Enterococci, Pseudomonas, and Clostridium difficile. Attendants usually do not get infected, partly because they are less vulnerable than their patients. They wash their hands before leaving the environment, and they have generated some immunity to the hospital organisms. But they certainly, particularly if hand washing is not practiced between interacting with different patients, they certainly have the potential to transmit parasites between patients. And so this is another one of my figures that I drew up way back in 1995. So for some pathogens, the sicker you are, the more likely transmission will occur. And so what we have here is a healthcare worker that's paying more attention to the more sick individual, which again harks back to the ideas of childbirth fever being more easily transmitted if a woman dies in the hospital. Certainly dying, an individual that has died is a sick patient, and they had more attention from the physicians who then autopsied them than they would have had if in fact they had not died. And so this healthcare worker is attending the sicker patient more than this more robust patient here on the right. And all over those little dots are little bacteria that he or she has picked up on their hand. By the way, this was drawn with the Windows Paint program way back when. That was the level of technology I had available to me when I first started teaching at OSU. So sit and wait parasites, I've already mentioned. So sit and wait parasites, they're able to sit and wait like those Giardia cysts. They basically have a high amount of durability, and they can persist within the environment until essentially the next susceptible host comes to them rather than they going to the next host. So rules of thumb. So there's less concern about host health. Particularly in the medium term. In the short term, you want to maintain at least enough health so that the host can make lots and lots and lots of you. There's a short transmissibility window out of the host, and this is because basically the goal is to make lots of babies, lots of progeny, and have them dispersed into the environment in some capacity. And because these are not being transmitted by direct contact, there is or by vectors, there's no need for the transmissibility window to be large, because out of the host, there really is no reason to sustain the out of the host phase for long periods of time. They just dump all of their progeny out of the host, potentially in just a single short-term step, and then the transmissibility is maintained over long periods outside of the host. There's less concern about host mobility, except to the extent that there may be more preferable places for the host to dump their load of parasites and less preferable ones. But if the dumping is occurring in one step, then basically as long as the host does that dumping in a location where the parasite has the potential to be picked up by another host, that's good enough for the parasite. Now, here's a key aspect of these parasites is that there has to be a high extra host durability. This is as we described for Giardia as well, and that's because the sit and wait parasites sit around in the environment waiting for hosts to come to them, and the longer that they can remain viable, infectable in the environment, then the longer their transmissivity then the longer their transmissibility window lasts of going into new hosts. And they also have the potential for causing very high levels of disease. And in part, this is because one of the things sit and wait parasites can do is they can actually kill their host. And as either in the course of transmitting or just following that transmission, because their goal is to get as many of their kind out of the host into the environment rather than necessarily sustaining over long time periods their movement out of the host. And so potentially high disease severity, as long as you kill the host after transmission has occurred, it's okay. So virulence can be severe, limited mostly by the virulence impact on within-host parasite replication. So if virulence is interfering with the ability of the host to support the production of more parasites, that might not be a good thing. But as long as it doesn't interfere with parasite production, then really any level of virulence is okay, or can be okay. This actually, you see this in some saprophytic bacteria, for example, the Clostridia, which in fact can kill their hosts. And then continue to replicate, because what they normally would do for a living is replicate on dead tissue. And so it doesn't matter at all if the host is killed, because their job is to simply to replicate on the dead tissue that's created often by their own actions, and then to produce endospores, which can last for long periods in the environment, allowing for new hosts to come to them. So the sit and wait parasites can be transmitted from very ill people, relying on the mobility of susceptible rather than infected people. The high durability of smallpox, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and Corynebacterium diphtheriae in the exterior environment helps to explain why these pathogens have been scourges throughout history. The agent of plague, Yersinia pestis, also can be transmitted as a durable pathogen by the respiratory route. So there's not a whole lot of incentive for sit and wait pathogens to keep their hosts healthy. And as a consequence, there is a tendency for these sit and wait pathogens to be really severe in the amount of disease they cause. So this is an example of a sit and wait pathogen, baculovirus. So baculovirus infects, for example, these caterpillars and produces large numbers of viruses inside the caterpillars and then literally dissolves the tissues of the caterpillars. The caterpillars turn into puddles, what's being shown here on the right. And these puddles have high densities of viruses within them. And those puddles can sit in locations awaiting for new parasites, for new hosts to come along, chomp, chomp, chomp through leaves and pick up these viruses, thereby continuing the infection cycle. So this is a caterpillar that has not melted, and this is a caterpillar on the right that's in the process of melting right there on a leaf where it can infect a subsequent caterpillar. And then there are sexually transmitted diseases. So rules of thumb. There is an important need on the part of sexually transmitted parasites to maintain host health, because if you aren't healthy, you're not having sex. There's also an importance to maintain host mobility, because if you can't move, you're probably not having sex. There's also a long transmissibility window from the host, and this is because individuals often perhaps don't change partners too often, and the opportunity to transmit to a new host via sex, in the course of sex, is dependent upon, in fact, participating in sex with a new partner. And if that doesn't happen all the time, that is, new partners don't come along all the time, then you need a long transmissibility window in order to be able to take advantage of when, in fact, the new partners come along. You can't kill the host prior to the host having sex with this new partner. And you also can't be cleared up by the host, by the host's immune system before this new partner comes along. You have to persist in the host. The host has to remain healthy and mobile, wanting to participate in sex. It does no good that you are continuing to participate in sex with your current partner, because if it's a sexually transmitted disease, where did you get the sexually transmitted disease from? It's probably your current partner. And so therefore, in order for the disease to be transmitted to a new partner, it's got to stick around in an infective state until that new partner comes along. There tends to be low extra host durability because these parasites tend not to leave their hosts. When they are transmitted, they're transmitted pretty much in intimate contact with the host that they came from, and then to the host that they're going to. And also, there can be a potential for high disease severity in the long term. And this can come about because these parasites have to maintain themselves in the host that they're infecting for such long periods of time. So they're good at evading the host's immune system. And also, they last a long period of time, which means that mutations that give rise to higher levels of expedience, higher levels of virulence can accumulate, resulting in the disease eventually turning into one that's more severe. So, for example, HIV turning into AIDS after a number of years of infection. So virulence initially is low but can become severe with time. A person generally has sex with many fewer people per week than he can sneeze on. Natural selection therefore favors long-term persistence and contagiousness of sexually transmitted pathogens within each host. Accordingly, most sexually transmitted pathogens are characterized by adaptations that allow the pathogen to evade the immune system, to persist in and be transmitted from the body. So this is HIV, which of course is a sexually transmitted disease. What we have here is the basically viral load of HIV. This is as shown in the blood. And what we have here is a decline, essentially, in immune system functionality. And so HIV begins with an acute infection, but then has a long-term persistence as a chronic low-level infection that eventually gives way to a severe disease. So this is the seropositivity occurs within this window in the course of the severe initial acute disease. There are flu-like symptoms. They consist of a number of different symptoms that are somewhat systemic. Basically, we have a viral infection going on. Now, there's a long-term transmissibility window when the individual that's HIV infected is not sick. So initially, they're quite sick. And eventually, they're quite sick. But there's this long, multi-year middle period during which the virus is present, when transmissibility is possible, but the hosts themselves are not terribly sick. And this is a tendency that you'll see among sexually transmitted diseases. They tend not to make the host very sick. Because again, if the host is too sick, they're not going to be having sex, or no one's going to want to have sex with them. And as a consequence, the potential for transmission would be low. So instead, sexually transmitted parasites, they need to not have a huge impact on the health of their host so that they can increase their likelihood of transmission. And of course, it's also important for that likelihood of transmission to last for as long as possible. So this ability to persist for long periods can lead eventually to the parasite instead essentially getting out of the immune system control and causing a substantial amount of damage. And this, as I said, also can be a consequence of ongoing mutations among the infecting parasite population that leads to higher levels of virulence, which are eventually selected because of their greater potential to replicate within a host, are eventually selected within that host, giving rise to greater levels of virulence. So switching gears quite a bit, let's return to horizontal gene transfer. So you've got a pathogen or a parasite. And if you look at the parasite's genome, there's a certain number of genes, a substantial number of genes that are surviving over time. This is over many, many generations, evolutionary time. In the course of this, unneeded genes, in fact, can be lost. And in fact, you see this a lot with parasites. When an organism takes up a parasitic existence, there's a lot of redundancies suddenly with the functions that that are associated with its host. And the parasite, therefore, can lose gene function that are basically no longer needed. The parasite becomes degenerative, it degenerates. It basically stops having to do lots of things that it would have needed to have done as a free living organism, but no longer needs to do in association or intimate association with some host organism. In addition, the parasite can be subject to the acquisition of new genes, and of course those genes that pass the test of natural selection will be retained, and the rest of them will tend not to be. So over time, there's changes in the parasite genome. There can be losses of genes, and there also can be some gains of genes. As a whole, one may view pathogen evolution as the gain of genes via horizontal gene transfer, coupled with the loss of genes necessary from a population genetic point of view. In other words, the genome can't grow in size infinitely. There's got to be something balancing gains in genes. Which changes the ecological capabilities of the bacterial taxon. So the bacterium will gain genes, and that allows them to essentially invade new niches. Within those niches, they can lose genes because of redundancy with the functions of the host cell or the host organism. And so you can see a progression of the evolution of parasites. So we start with this free living organism. It is benign. It doesn't cause diseases. And that organism, due to horizontal gene transfer, such as the gain of pathogenicity islands, might become pathogenic. Initially, it may be a relatively broad host range pathogen, in other words, able to make a number of different entities sick, or at least be associated with a number of different entities. But with time, there may be specialization. So this can be a consequence of antagonistic pleiotropy, where an organism gets better and better at doing what it does, but it comes at the expense of doing something else. In this case, it gets better at being associated, infecting a given host, and that comes at the expense of its ability to infect another host. This is basically what we were talking about when we considered the serial passage experiments early on, where adaptation to the host that an organism is being serially passaged in will tend to lead to a reduction in its functionality in its old host. You then can see an increase in potentially the virulence of the now narrow host range pathogen. And this potentially can lead to these pathogens isolating themselves from sources of horizontal gene transfer, sources with which they can exchange genes. If the pathogen is something that tends to exchange genes, particularly with members of its own species, which is pretty much an assumption you can make for any kind of microorganism, the exchange of genes outside their species would be considered to be relatively rare. but within its species can be fairly high. If you have this going on, you can have the potential for the pathogen to cut itself off from horizontal gene transfer. And at this point, if you have low population numbers and without sex, no recombination, you can end up with organisms that in fact are showing degeneration in their genomes, such as you see with Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And then these organisms can experience further gene loss and further genomic decay, the generation of pseudogenes from otherwise functional genes, and you can have organisms that increasingly are less capable of functioning apart from their host organism, and also may increasingly become more isolated from other organisms with which they can exchange genes. And ultimately, you end up with this obligate host-dependent pathogen, such as the rickettsia and the mycoplasma, which are very small genomed and are not really able to effectively replicate outside of the host environment. Mycobacterium leprae also really can't replicate outside of the environment of the host organism. So there is not just an evolution of virulence in the course of pathogen evolution, but also an evolution of the functionality of the pathogens themselves. And it's not just natural selection that drives this. It also is genetic drift, and in fact, Mueller's ratchet can play a role as well, where you have loss of genotypes in the course of a low population sizes and a lack of horizontal gene transfer.